Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and it's Saturday. It's Vault time. This episode originally aired on February 10th, 2022, and it's on the phenomenon of paleo burrows. Shall we go into the tunnels, Rob?
Let's venture in.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and I think today we're doing tunnels, is that right?
Yeah, we're going to venture into some strange tunnels in the earth. I don't know about you, Joe, but I love a good creepy tunnel story. You know, any caliber of motion picture, if you have like a subway tunnel and you have a monster shambling around down there, or even possibility of a monster shambling around down there, I'm generally on board.
Oh yeah, I mean it's one of the classics in, you know, your fairy tale types. One of the big ones is you got to go into the underworld, right?
What's
closer in physical reality to an underworld than cave or a tunnel?
Caves and tunnels. Yeah, I mean, humans have long been fascinated by them. You know, we see a cave, we want to get in there. We need to know what's going on. We need to find out what kind of sacred secrets are contained in there. And so, you know, I'm also continually fascinated by tales of you know, modern tunnel systems, abandoned tunnel systems from further back in history. I also love a good, you know, tunnel of unknown origin story, such as the strange tunnels in the Hyperion novels. Or, another film in this case that had some strange tunnels. There's the whole tunnel plot line in Jordan Peele's 2019 film, Us.
Yeah, yeah.
That one.
Let's not spoil anything about that.
No, I'm not going to spoil anything, but it does open with a fun text crawl. Quote, there are thousands of miles of tunnels beneath the United States, abandoned subway systems, unused service routes, and deserted mine shafts. Many have no known purpose at all. So instantly I was, you know, on board for that.
I love a good informational legend like that.
Now, the fun thing about that quote is that it's a fun one to ponder over, because on one hand, it's sort of true. There are a lot of abandoned tunnel systems in the United States, some with some pretty engaging stories about them at times. You know, old mines, abandoned subway projects, abandoned subway lines. I'm a real sucker for that sort of thing. Also, you know, ultimately, I think this is the film in question is one that maybe doesn't, you're not supposed to take it completely seriously and think, well, there's this entire system of tunnels and who knows what's going on down there. But it also reminds me of what we're talking about here today, the story of mysterious tunnels and caverns in South America.
Now, what makes today's example really interesting is
normally you're going to think about your mysterious tunnels in two categories. One is obviously, you know, a cave of geologic origin. You know, here's a millions of years old a cave with stalactites and stalagmites, clearly a water formed cavity of some type. But then the other bucket, of course, is who made this tunnel? What human dug this and for what purpose? But actually, those two categories leave out another option, don't they?
Yeah, and it's not aliens. The fun thing about this is you don't need aliens to get to the wow moment, to the amazing content of this particular topic, because we still seem to be dealing with a non-human entity. A non-human will behind these tunnels or caves or burrows, is probably more appropriate to call them, these paleo burrows of South America. They're not the work of a pre-Columbian society. They're older, and they're quite impressive. Well, but as we dive in here, I want to mention that that one of my main sources here is an excellent book that came out, I believe, in 2017. By Anthony J. Martin, a paleontologist at Emory University here in Atlanta, titled "The Evolution Underground: Burrows, Bunkers, and the Marvelous Subterranean World Beneath Our Feet." I've been meaning to cover this book in some form or another for a while, and I saw it on the shelf again. I was like, "All right, today's the day. I'm gonna bust this book out and see what grabs my attention."
So I haven't read this yet, but my interest is piqued because I, like you, love a tunnel, a burrow, a den under the earth. But I was familiar with Anthony J. Martin's name, and I'm not sure, but I think it was because he was one of the authors of research from 2007 that was famous for documenting the first fossil evidence of a dinosaur that dug tunnels. Did you read about this?
Yeah, this is covered in the book. Yeah, there's some wonderful illustrations, and even in one case, I believe a bit of folk art depicting these creatures, which I loved.
So the brief rundown on this: the paper where they described this find came out in 2007 in Proceedings of the Royal Society B, Biological Sciences. It was by David J. Verricchio, Anthony J. Martin, and Yoshihiro Katsura. And it was called "First Trace in Body Fossil Evidence of a Burrowing, Denning Dinosaur." So this fossil find came from a formation in southwest Montana, near the border with Idaho. I think it was called the Blackleaf Formation. And this formation dates back to the mid-Cretaceous period. The find consisted of both the trace fossil of the burrow itself, as well as skeletal fossils found inside. The skeletal fossils were of one adult and two juveniles, which apparently all died and were fossilized inside the burrow. The dinosaur was a member of a previously undiscovered species of Ornithischia, which the authors name Oryctodromius cubicularis. And that genus name, Oryctodromius, that means digging runner. So that gives you a hint of like the two main talents of the stat build of this dinosaur. These would have been herbivorous dinosaurs that lived roughly 90-something million years ago. And so one question you might wonder is, well, how do we know that the dinosaurs we found inside actually made the tunnel or burrow instead of just, I don't know, finding a naturally occurring hollow or tunnel made by some other mysterious creature? Well, it seems likely that the dinosaurs themselves made it because of the creature's anatomy and because of its relationship to the burrow. So in the words of the authors, quote, "The features of the snout, shoulder girdle, and pelvis are consistent with digging habits." So it has multiple anatomical adaptations you would expect to find in a creature that specializes in digging. Like it's got a snout that is sort of fused together in a way that would make it kind of a good shovel for like kicking soil back and forth. And its skeletal structure seems well put together to kind of brace itself with the back limbs or the pelvis as it uses its forelimbs to dig and throw soil out behind it.
Yeah, this is something that's touched on with various organisms in this book, that an organism needs the tools for burrowing or digging, but it's not just a matter of having claws or some sort of snout. It also needs the body to back it up. And so we can look at the bodies of many of these organisms that are extinct now, and we can make very informed guesses about what their body had evolved to do.
Right. You need the right kind of chassis to give you leverage with which to dig. Because you remember, digging is not just about what the hands are doing in the front, the forelimbs scraping away at things. The bracing is really important. You got to hold your ground while you're scraping.
Yes. Yeah. You can't just put a big scoop on the front of your, your Prius and say you're going to go out and start moving earth around.
But another clue that the dinosaurs inside this burrow dug it were the fact that the burrow almost perfectly matches the width and breadth of the torso of the adult. Mm-hmm. So it seems like this is a burrow of the right size to have been dug by the adult dinosaur. And the adult is found along with two juveniles inside the burrow. And they were found with no bite marks or anything on the bones, no signs of carnivore bone assemblies like you might sometimes find where, a carnivore is dumping all the bones from its recent meals. So it looks like this was not just a tunnel dug by a dinosaur, but one that an adult dinosaur lived inside with its juveniles. And this would provide evidence of a case of extended parental care in dinosaurs, something that I think was less well evidenced and more controversial at the time. And based on the size of the juveniles, it appears that this parental care had gone on for at least several months.
Yeah. This is in stark contrast to some of the hypothesized ways that, say, giant sauropods would have dealt with their young. I remember discussing that on the podcast where, at least one hypothesis was that, the eggs kind of just fall out and they just roll to the side and then they do their thing.
See ya. Yeah.
Yeah. Totally different parenting strategy.
Anyway, the authors of this paper note that vertebrates today create burrows, of course, for a number of reasons. Some actually use tunneling as a food foraging strategy, trying to get underground food. Some use it for escaping predators. That's a common one. It's a type of shelter that protects you. And some use it for avoiding the elements in harsh environments. But the other half of the equation is that this animal, Oryctodromius, was also a cursor, which means a runner. Remember, the name means digging runner. Hmm. And the authors of this paper say that if we look at analogies today, running animals that create burrows tend to do so for a pretty specific reason, which is they create them as dens for rearing their young. So once you give birth to young, the juveniles are pretty vulnerable for a while until they get bigger, big enough to run around and defend themselves like an adult can. And so a den provides a place to protect the young while they're growing and still vulnerable.
Now, Joe, you included a fabulous bit of paleo art here from this study. This is actually in the book as well. I love a good bit of paleo art, but here we see the parent. We see a cutaway of the burrow, and we see the two young dinos at the bottom.
I like that the paleo artist in this case has chosen to depict the adult Oryctodromius as Sam the Eagle from the Muppets. It has a very severe eyebrow and a very, I think this is anatomically accurate, the beak-like mouth.
Yes.
Well, anyway, sorry if that was a digression from the paleo burrows, but I just wanted to say, yeah, so you're looking at this book by Anthony J. Martin, and Martin has a history with the diggers.
Yeah, and Martin knows his tunnels and his burrows here, and so he discusses the paleo burrows in The Evolution Underground, pointing out that geologists in Argentina and Brazil noted these burrows back in the 1920s and the 1930s. Some had partially or wholly filled with sediment, but others remained quite open. They were cut in a variety of soft igneous metamorphic and sedimentary bedrock. So we're talking about rock here. That's one of the important and I think really impressive things about this. Some were visible in outcrops, others as cylindrical chambers. There are some wonderful photographs you can find online and attached to various articles about these, papers about these. They're quite impressive. They look just like a tunnel cut through a rock. You can they look like they look like real tunnels. We're not just talking about just an indention in the side of a hill.
Yeah, some of them look like somebody brought in the boring machine. Like they are a large, like several meter wide, basically circular cylindrical tunnel. Others are smaller, more compact, or more kind of a half moon shape. But I just wanted to flag it. This was interesting because so Martin notes that, that people had previously observed these things in the 20s and 30s in Argentina and Brazil. Now, I had been reading about the paleo burrows in some articles that came out in 2017. And those articles were essentially saying that nobody had ever reported these things until just recently, that they'd just sort of come on the radar. But it seems like Martin has turned up some other previous reports of these things.
Yeah, yeah, that's what seems to be the case. But the important thing is they weren't exactly sure what they were looking at here.
Yeah,
now, over the decades to follow, hundreds of these caves were uncovered, with a lot of concentration in the area of what is now Rio Grande do Sul in southern Brazil. Other paleo burrows of this nature are simply undiscovered. I've seen a total number expressed somewhere around like 1,500. And again, there are likely others as well that haven't been discovered or will never be discovered, you know.
Yeah, the reporting I was reading said that most of these are clustered in kind of strange geographical bands, like right in this area in southern Brazil, but not further south than like Uruguay. But then if you go even further south, there are some more down further into Argentina.
Yeah. So the archaeologists came back and they were studying them with renewed interest in the 70s and 80s, and they hypothesized that these were surely the work of human beings. Martin writes, quote, considering their proportions and geological setting, this was a perfectly reasonable hypothesis, as they superficially resembled human-made tunnels and chambers in Cappadocia and elsewhere. Now, Cappadocia is noted here as is a place in what is modern-day Turkey, where you have these wonderful historic cave houses that can still be seen today. Joe, you might be interested to also note that they filmed parts of Yor, the Hunter from the Future here.
Yes, there are quite clear signs of it. The movie has scenes of its muscly superstar, Reb Brown, scuttling around over these beautiful rock formations. I think he fights a dinosaur in what is clearly Cappadocia.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better.
because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Now, while some of these paleo burrows, again in South America, were too small to have served as anything other than hiding places for children, he writes that others were large enough to have potentially been human dwellings. The largest were as wide as 13 feet or 4 meters. They were 6.6 feet tall or 2 meters. And they were more than 330 feet long, or about 100 meters in length. So again, in many of these cases, we're not just talking about some sort of a narrow burrow, but something that that a family or a small group could have lived in. Quote, moreover, some tunnels connected with one another or join larger sub-spherical chambers to make more complicated networks. Once put together, some of these spaces feasibly could have served as underground homes for families or small communities. A few even contain petroglyphs, showing that pre-Columbian people entered at least some of them. And as we've touched on already, I know there's a long history of humans using naturally occurring caves, if not for shelter, then for other purposes, be it like a burial or some sort of sacred purpose, or in some cases, we're not sure exactly what that purpose might have been. And then we have excellent examples of places like Cappadocia, which we just mentioned, which demonstrate that if local geologic conditions are conducive to excavation, then homes can be manufactured in the substance of the earth. There are also various traditions of pit houses, partially buried or excavated homes. Again, it just kind of depends on the culture, what's available there in the given environment. But in looking at these paleo burrows, researchers began to notice things that made it less likely that humans built these particular tunnels at all. So first of all, while artifacts and petroglyphs did factor into some of these sites, we did not find anywhere near the amount of human bones and human artifacts that we'd expect to find at a place where humans lived. Humans visited, but they did not seem to live here. And this is something that, you think of any of the episodes we've recorded or anything you read about ancient sites of human habitation, you have these layers you can go through. You can essentially sort through the garbage of human civilizations and learn what they were up to and how long they were there.
Mm-hmm.
And in these cases, it does not seem like there are enough artifacts, enough remains, or even enough petroglyphs to indicate that they were here. And that's another thing. Petroglyph rarity in these tunnels indicated, according to Martin, quote, folks were not inspired enough to hang out in these places and make art. Another fact, and this gets into the artifact issue as well, is indigenous peoples in eastern South America did not have access to the right materials for rock carving tools, and no evidence of said tools were found. So again, getting back into the lack of artifacts to support the idea that humans made these burrows and or lived here. So during the 1980s, researchers began to turn their attention away from human beings. They looked at the scale of these caves and tunnels. The small child-sized tunnels that we mentioned, they decided were likely the result of a smaller burrowing prehistoric animal such as a giant armadillo. But the grand caves and tunnels, the ones in which human families or communities could have potentially lived, a new hypothesis emerged for these architects. And it's not human beings. It's not flowing water or natural geologic processes. It is the giant ground sloth.
The big boys.
The big boys, yeah. So I know we've talked about sloths, extant sloth species on the show before, and I guess giant ground sloths have come up at least a time or two, but I don't think we've really discussed like what they were and why they're so cool. Because today we have in the world, I believe, six extant species of arboreal sloths. You know, they live in the trees, and these are certainly weird and wonderful animals. I'll be the first to admit that they can be a bit of a bore if you encounter them in the zoo. You know, they're typically just, you know, bunched in the corner of a of an exhibit, you know, just chilling or staying warm.
I find that they often look like a wig hanging on a hook.
Yeah. And I'm not commenting on their happiness or lack of happiness there, but they're not as interesting. They're not magical to behold. But in the wild, they come off like these just strange elemental spirit beings. I had the privilege to glimpse one in the wild once, and it was just magical. It's got like this kind of thing that like slowly emerges out of the canopy in the distance, and you glimpse it for a short amount of time, and then it's gone.
They're also magical in a different way if you get up close enough to see their face, because they often appear to be smiling.
Yes, they have a very their faces are in this wonderful place that where they, you know, we lean into anthropomorphizing them rather easily. They look kind of like they're smiling. They look a little derpy, which is which is cue to cuteness. And don't even get us started on baby sloths. Absolutely adorable. So we have today three-toed sloths and two-toed sloths. This refers to the four limbs only. And these represent two distantly related families that experience convergent evolution to arboreal life.
Okay, so the sloth lineage is not one that always existed in the trees. The species we have today are the ones that happened to move into the trees at some point in deep history.
That's right, yeah, because plenty of these other sloths, or sloths, if you rather, I believe that's the British pronunciation.
Yeah.
Many of them were ground sloths, and in some cases we're talking giant ground sloths. And these can be quite impressive. I've enjoyed looking at bones, fossil exhibits of these over time. There's also a wonderful full-scale, muddy and shaggy recreation of a ground sloth at Atlanta's own Fernbank Museum of Natural History. I don't know if you've been over to see this, Joe, but it's in the A Walk Through Time in Georgia exhibit.
Yeah, I have been through that before, though I don't remember exactly what this one looks like. I wonder if there's a picture of it online. Hold on. Oh, yeah, okay, here it is. I remember this now. Okay, this sloth needs a bath. First of all, it is filthy. It looks really gross.
Yeah, it's impressive. I imagine it's been, I don't know how long it's been there, but it has to have been impressing school children for quite a while at this point. And I hope that if at some point they change anything in that exhibit, they keep the sloth. This would have been an
keep it dirty.
Yeah, keep it dirty. Keep it on display. This would have, I believe, this would have been an Aramotherium, which was a giant ground sloth that would have lived 4.9 million years ago to around 11,000 years ago, and it was a pretty big guy, rivaling but not surpassing the Megatherium in size. Now, Megatherium, this is the biggest of the known ground sloths of prehistoric times. Megatherium is Latin for the great beast.
Oh, I've never put that together before. The therium being beast, but that would be like as in the word theriomorphic, taking the form of a beast.
Yeah. So these guys reached heights of 20 feet or 6 meters. And they probably weighed roughly 4 tons, dealing with adults here, obviously. It was, simply put, the sloth as megafauna, filling that niche in the ecosystem. A giant eating machine that didn't have to worry too much about predators, ate a lot to maintain their enormous bodies, and then also slept a lot to digest it. This particular guy would have been as big as an elephant and exceeded, at the time, only in size terrestrial mammals by some mammoths during its day. So this was a huge animal. And while there are some, I think these are mainly controversial, there's a controversial hypothesis that it might have been partially carnivorous, perhaps feasting on scavenged dead animals, such as, I believe, the glyptodonts. But it's widely thought, I believe, that they were merely selective herbivores. Mm-hmm. Though there are some ground sloths that I think there's more robust evidence that they may have been sporadically omnivorous, such as the Mylodon darwini, there was, I believe, a 2021 study looking at the coprolites of it, the fossil poo of this particular sloth, and they determined that, yeah, it was probably scavenging some meat here and there to make things, to make ends meet.
Though, as we've discussed on the show several times, there are actually there's quite robust documentation that many animals we think of as pretty much strictly herbivorous will, in some strange occasions, eat meat.
Right.
Nature is just pretty opportunistic. I mean, it's going to take what it gets.
Yeah. So, this is just a starter on just how weird and strange these sloths truly were. I mean, they're huge. There's this idea that some of them are also eating a little meat here and there. But then when you start realizing that, okay, looking at these paleo burrows, we're talking about giant ground sloths that were not just digging in mud and dirt. They were burrowing through rock. We're just in a whole different dimension of wonder here, in my opinion. Martin writes that as paleontologists in Argentina and Brazil started looking closer at the paleo burrows, they began to find clear signs that they seemed to have been made by giant sloths. They were, first of all, they saw there were groove marks in the walls that matched the size and claw count of ground sloths, usually two-toed. And then also the dimensions of the tunnels pointed towards the sloths. These were not smooth and cylindrical tunnels, but, quote, a series of semi-elliptical chambers with flat floors, but ceilings that were possibly buffed out into concave shapes by the sloths' backs. And the resulting complexes of tunnels and rooms, again, this feeling that you're going into a multi-chambered subterranean habitat, these were likely the result of many generations of ground sloths returning to a given site year after year. So not just one creating this, but, you know, coming back to the same location and essentially adding on to it.
Right. And from what I was reading, these paleo burrows, they vary greatly in, like, size and complexity, right? So some are just sort of a straight cylinder that goes a ways in and then terminates. But there are these other ones, like you're talking about, that have these more elaborate branching tunnels and right. Sometimes open up into what appear to be kind of rooms inside.
Yeah, yeah. And these, you know, I guess we could, it's difficult to compare these types of constructions to human constructions. But, you know, it's kind of like thinking about, well, think about a newspaper shop. Sometimes it's a freestanding place. Out here on a street with nothing around it. Other times, well, it's got this thing next to it and this other thing, and I guess it depends on just how much sloth activity was going on in that given spot, like how prime this location was for the burrows, and how many generations of animals were coming back to this place and digging these spaces out and redigging them.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. Just $25 a month, every month. Taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really.
It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Okay, so another interesting point of comparison based on the articles I was reading versus Martin's take on this is that the stuff I was reading made it seem like it was less well agreed on what exactly had made these tunnels and why, and that ground sloths and extinct species of armadillos were the main contenders. But it sounds like Martin is way more on the sloths side.
Yes, yeah. And he writes that when you look at giant ground sloth anatomy as well, especially Scelodotherium and Glossotherium, you find that their claw hands have these closely spaced thick fingers that make for, quote, natural shovels when applied against soft rock. They also had, you know, coming back to our example earlier, they had the muscle to back it all up. They had the forelimbs and the shoulders. He compares it to the muscles necessary for a galloping power, like a galloping horse, except that in this case, it's applied to digging. So instead of running, this is power that's clearly meant to dig. Also, their center of gravity was more toward the rear of the body, which he indicates would be more in line with the creature that's burrowing.
Hmm.
Now, these two species that he ends up writing about, they're not quite as big as the Megatherium, but Martin, he compares them to automobiles. So he says that the Scelodotherium was the size of a smart Fortwo electric car. These are these kind of mini car. I didn't really know what these were called, but you see them out driving around.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I didn't know what these were called either. But yeah, they're like the little cars, I don't know what you like compact electric cars you might see you imagine driving around some European city or something.
Right, right. And then he says that Glossotherium was more the size of an average midsize car. That you know, we do some car ads for this show occasionally, and I think we need to start asking the advertisers to indicate what species of extinct ground sloth was the size of this vehicle, so that you know, listeners will be a little bit more informed about their potential auto purchases.
Right.
Now, while Martin doesn't really discuss Megatherium in his book, but it seems like Megatherium may have burrowed as well. I found some articles that were talking about the Megatherium and burrowing possibilities. But this kind of blew me away. There's at least one hypothesis out there that Megatherium might have been hairless, like a naked mole rat, like a towering naked mole rat. Yeah. And I included a bit of paleo art here indicating what this might have looked like. I found it completely strange and wonderful.
Oh, yeah, because you shared this with me, and he looks like the engineers from the Alien franchise.
Yeah, you managed to even find a pose from one of the engineers where it looks like they're doing the same pose here.
Yeah. I wish I could have done it, though. What would have been perfect is if it was the engineer, but he had the mask on, like when they find the body in the original Alien.
Oh, goodness, yeah, because this naked giant sloth head, its fleshy head with its, it would have, you know, probably had a pretty like fleshy lip situation for all of the delicate consumption of tree bits. It looks a lot like that mask that they wear in those movies.
Okay, so wait a minute. Did you credit this hypothesis yet?
No, I haven't yet.
Okay, because I've got a comment.
Okay, this is a hypothesis by a paleontologist from Uruguay, Richard A. Farina. He wrote a paper in 2002 titled "Megatherium: The Hairless Appearances of the Great Quaternary Sloths," arguing that this is in part because modern large, this may be the case, he's arguing, in part because modern large mammals such as elephants and rhinos are mostly hairless to prevent overheating in hot climates.
Okay, so as far as I'm aware, this is not the dominant view of these ancient ground sloths, but this is one idea. This is funny because I came across yet another paper where one of the two authors is the same guy, Richard Farina. This one was from 1996 in Proceedings of the Royal Society B by Farina and somebody named R.E. Blanco. And this one is called Megatherium the Stabber. That's the title of the paper. And this one hypothesizes, now you may have already sort of touched on this when talking about the different ideas about the diets of these sloths, but here Farina and Blanco are looking at characteristics of the remains of the giant ground sloth of Megatherium and saying, maybe it wasn't so herbivorous. they write, quote, Megatherium americanum had morphological features that are better explained by its having had carnivorous habits rather than by solely herbivorous ones, specifically the question of its forearms having been designed for optimizing speed rather than strength of extension is addressed. So they argue that the anatomy of the forearms is such that this is an animal that would have been using vicious attacks with its claws rather than just sort of slow extending actions of like tearing branches out of trees or something. And then they also say that the high mechanical advantage of the Megatherium's biceps would have made it possible for the animal to have lifted and carried heavy weights. And they're like, well, what if this means it was like turning animals over to get at the soft underbelly?
Yeah.
I'm not sure if anybody agrees with this today. This seems possibly out there, but I like the idea that Farina has made a career, at least partially, on proposing alternate interpretations of the Megatherium.
Yeah, I think I did look at part of this paper. The idea, I think, is that glyptodonts, it would have been like turning the glyptodont over and then using the claws and the forearms to like dig into the belly and start eating the flesh.
Right. Get that thing, flip it, and then stab with the claws.
Yeah. And I'm not sure entirely if we're talking about a living glyptodont or a dead one. If we're ultimately talking, is he arguing like this was the mighty hunter, or that basically it's eating a lot of plants, but if it finds a dead glyptodont, yeah, it's going to flip it over and dig in a little bit.
They're saying predatory behavior. So again, I want to be very clear. I've not found any indication that this is a widely accepted interpretation of Megatherium remains.
But interesting hypothesis, you know?
Yeah, it's funny.
All right, so coming back to Paleoboros, one of the big remaining questions, and ultimately, I guess, one of the big remaining mysteries is, okay, so if we're going to go with the hypothesis that these were dug out by giant ground sloths, why did they burrow in the ground? Why did they seem to come back to the same places, year after year, generation after generation, and maintain these spaces? So Martin gets into this, because the whole book is about, deals with questions of why animals do this. Why is the burrow advantageous? Why has it helped? Why in some cases did it enable certain creatures to survive cataclysms on the earth? Yeah. Well, Martin points out that, okay, if we're looking at the smaller paleoburrows, we're looking at the work presumed to be created by giant armadillos, he thinks they likely burrowed for the same reason that modern armadillos do. It's safer underground. It allows them to hide somewhere that major predators cannot go. And so these ancient armadillos, even though they were bigger than what we have today, they would still have to avoid things like saber-toothed cats and short-faced bears. But when we look at the great ground sloths here, digging tunnels so big that they wouldn't have been able to keep these predators out, we have a slightly different situation. And we're also dealing with creatures that were large enough in some cases that they probably didn't really have to worry about these predators, not while they were healthy at any rate, certainly when you get into young being around, that's a different situation. But they're not as threatened by these predators And they also are not creating spaces that would adequately protect them anyway.
Right.
Yeah. So, I mean, these are kind of the perks of being megafauna, with only climate change and human hunting seeming to be big enough threats to end their reigns.
Mm-hmm.
According to Martin, the most popular current hypothesis here is that the primary reason that the giant ground sloths dug these tunnels was ultimately to cope with a climate that was drier than today's. So the idea here is the cave would have maintained more humid conditions as well as an average temperature, thus helping the animal out no matter what the outside temperature is, if it's colder or hotter than what would be comfortable for the organism.
Now, that is interesting, and it also makes me think about how I think it's certainly the case that when animals get bigger, they have more heat dissipation problems to worry about, right?
Right. So this hypothesis seems to revolve, you know, roughly around that. Like, how does this large ground sloth maintain appropriate body temperatures? And I can only guess how this might mesh or not mesh with Farina's hairless ground sloth hypothesis. Like, does a hairless ground sloth, would it need to climb into a burrow even more? I don't know. This is not something that I think experts have weighed in on that I have seen. As a side note, I will say that I did notice that it looks like giant ground sloths do feature into some video games. I wonder if anyone has been inspired by Farina's hypotheses and decided to make them aggressive, and maybe they come up and, like, they, if you're in a vehicle, they turn your vehicle over and, like, dig you out through the bottom of the vehicle. That would be kind of cool.
Ground sloths, the naked stabber.
Yeah. Now, as I mentioned earlier, the ground sloths we're talking about, they did overlap with human beings for at least a short time, and it seems like human beings probably played a major role in their extinction. You know, there have been sites where we find evidence of butchery taking place with these giant ground sloths. So ultimately, human beings survive. Some arboreal sloths survive, but the age of the giant ground sloth came to an end.
Okay, so this is not super related to what we're talking about, but did you happen to read that thing about the giant ground sloths and the paper arguing that that like 22 of them that were found dead all in the same place died in a poop related mass casualty incident?
No, I did not.
So the paper was published in Paleogeography, Paleoclimatology, and Paleoecology in 2020 by Lindsay et al. And it was documenting a large death assemblage from the late Pleistocene in a place called Tanque Loma in the southwest of Ecuador. Mm-hmm. And so it was this place that had the remains of at least 22 different giant ground sloths, the Eremotherium larillardi. And they found all of these animals together in a deposition pattern that indicated that they basically all died right around the same time, gathered around this marshy little pool of water that looked like a place that had repeatedly been filled with water and then dried up and allowed plants to grow and then filled with water again. So maybe one of these sort of intermittent watering holes, places that sometimes have water and sometimes don't. And based on a number of cues around this area, the authors decided that they thought the most likely interpretation of what happened here is that a bunch of giant ground sloths were hanging out in and around this water, using it to cool their bodies and as a watering hole to drink from and to eat the plants that were growing around. And that by fouling this water source that was ever shrinking with their fecal matter, they essentially poop poisoned themselves and many of them ended up dying.
You know, I don't have, is there a paleo art to go with this one, Joe? Did you
That's find not it? Very inspiring for the children's books, is it?
Okay.
They end up writing, and there are modern analogies for this, found in like shrinking watering holes in present day savanna environments. They write, quote, "We suggest that this death event could have resulted from drought and or disease stemming from the contamination of the wallow, paralleling situations observed among hippopotamus populations in watering holes on the present day African savanna." So sometimes this apparently happens, like a watering hole in a dry area is filled with hippos, and they just keep pooping into it and drinking it, and obviously that's not good for them.
Hmm. Well, we can see how we can see like changing climates potentially impacting these situations as well. Yeah. So Martin in his book, again, the whole book is full of wonderful explorations of burrowing creatures, not all of which are vertebrates, for sure. I recommend picking that up if you're at all interested in this topic. But he writes that scientists would have once thought that creatures as large as these ground sloths would not have burrowed, that the burrowing creatures do not grow this big. But he points out that, in fact, the largest burrowing animals today are bears, especially, he says, if you count snow as a substrate for burrowing, which he does. I think we've all seen, he points out that we've all seen documentaries at this point showing polar bears doing that, burrowing in the snow, creating a burrow, for a mother polar bear anyway, for her young. And if you count snow as a substrate for burrowing, then that's burrowing, and that's a pretty impressive.
Interesting. So this comes in a way back to the dinosaur paper we talked about earlier, because this would primarily be a denning behavior for the protection of young while they're mm-hmm. while they're still vulnerable.
Yeah. Now I do have to mention as well that quite amusingly, and of course, very much touching on my interests, he also compares the giant ground sloth to the graboids from the 1990 movie Tremors. This was pretty fun when I was looking through the index on this when I first got the book. I was oh, he talks about Tremors at some point. This seems like our kind of scientist.
Because the giant ground sloths also had multiple snake tongues that would go out and get you.
Well, no, but he points out, like, he seems to be a fan of Tremors, but he points out that, okay, you have these fabulous worm-like creatures that are digging these tunnels, burrowing through the ground in this, corner of Nevada. He says, well, there would probably be some remnant of that. There would be some, there's some evidence of ancient graboids in this area where the burrowing would have taken place.
Right. So even if the animal decomposed, it would leave the trace fossils of its burrows.
Right. And I don't know, thinking back on the graboids, it looked like there were some hard parts that might fossilize.
Oh, yeah. Maybe that's beaks or something.
Yeah, the beak. Yeah. I don't know. Awaiting his full paper break, doing a breakdown of the graboids.
Now, wait a minute. Didn't we learn in some of the Deep Tremor sequels that they have multiple life cycle stages mm-hmm. and that some of them are like flying and junk like
running
that?
Around. There's a version with legs. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know that I ever really watched any of the sequels, but I have a lot of love for that first Tremors film. That was just, that's a pretty perfect monster movie. Pretty great cast.
So Kevin Bacon's not in the sequels. The sequels end up focusing more on...
He comes back at some point, or he was.
Oh,
because
does
they
he?
Did a TV series. They did a lot of, I think,
Oh, I didn't know that.
Sci-Fi Channel kind of sequels there. But then they did a TV show at some point, and I feel like Kevin Bacon finally came back.
The sequels I'm familiar with don't have Bacon. They focus more on that guy who's Reba's husband in the first one, the gun prepper guy.
Yeah, that played by Michael Gross.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, he's mm-hmm. he's the like heavily armed Dale Gribble guy in the first movie.
Yeah, he was in a bunch of them. I mean, he was fun in that.
I don't know why, but we often go around quoting Reba McEntire from the first Tremors movie. She's just got a lot of punchy delivery, You didn't get penetration even with the elephant gun.
Yeah, Reba's great in that.
Yeah.
Oh, and I am correct. There was a 2018 TV movie called Tremors, and it had the return of Kevin Bacon and Fred Ward. So there you go. I have not seen it. Can't vouch for it.
I apologize. I was wrong.
All right. Well, we're going to go ahead and close it.
Yep. Sorry. I just Googled it, and I found that, on Reba's website, she has a page dedicated to Tremors.
Oh, well, that's great.
So you can go to reba.com/tremors.
Let's also not forget that Victor Wong is in that and is also pretty fabulous.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
All right, we're going to go ahead and close it out here. But we'd love to hear from anyone out there who has thoughts on these. If you have any thoughts on giant ground sloths or modern arboreal sloths, everything is up for grabs here. Other interesting tunnels that you're aware of, be they... you know, naturally occurring caves and so forth, or modern or ancient human constructions that we're trying to figure out. We'd love to hear about all of that. In the meantime, if you would like to listen to more episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, you'll find us in the Stuff to Blow Your Mind podcast feed. Core episodes on Tuesdays and Thursdays, Listener Mail on Monday, Artifact on Wednesday, and on Friday we do Weird House Cinema. That's our time to set aside most serious matters and just talk about a strange film.
Big thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
There's two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health, with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid kombucha today.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.